Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. I have on the show with us once again today Dennis Wagner, Executive Director of the Access Research Network, who's going to talk with us about ARN's top 10 science news stories for 2009. Dennis, thanks for coming back on the show with us.
It's great to be here as always, Casey.
In our previous show, we talked about how ARN, every year for the last few years, has released the top 10 science news stories for each year, and you have just recently come out with the top 10 science news stories for 2009. And we went over the honorable mentions in the previous podcast, and this podcast, we're going to go into the actual top 10 stories. So before we get into that, Dennis, why do you do this? Why do you feel it's important to summarize the top 10 science news stories each year for your readers?
Well, I think because each of these stories by themselves may not be earth-shaking. You know, people may have explanations of why this one thing happened or this other thing happened. But I think as you look at the top 10 stories as a collection, it just really impresses you on the things that are happening and as far as discovery of design and nature, and also the articles and information that's being published by more and more scientists that are saying that Darwinism just doesn't match the data. And those two categories of stories are what we find in our top 10 this year. So we feel it's important, just like the news media does for the top 10 news stories of the year. They always seem to do that at the end of every year, and it's kind of a good way to reflect back on the year. And I always enjoyed reading those, and so I got the idea a couple of years ago, gee, we ought to do that for intelligent design, just see, you know, what's really happened this past year. Have we made any progress in this debate?
Well, that's great, Dennis, and we really appreciate the work you guys do and all of the great content that you guys provide on your website, ARN.org. And speaking of that, the number 10 top science story that you guys released for 2009 was actually discussed by David Tyler on the ID Literature Update blog, which I want to say to our listeners is just an absolutely fantastic blog. David Tyler does an amazing job of summarizing a lot of the latest research that comes out and discussing the implications for intelligent design. It's one of the top ID blogs out there, and he talked about a story that scientists are reverse engineering biological designs, and through a process called biomimetics, they're actually trying to model technology based upon biology. Can you tell us about this story and what sorts of biological systems are engineers and scientists trying to mimic when they create technology?
We're seeing a lot of these stories each year, and we just featured three of them this year in our top 10. The first one was engineers at MIT that basically reversed engineer the inner ear of the human to build kind of a solid state ear or hearing device, if you will. And one of the researchers there said the human ear is a very good spectrum analyzer. And he said, the more I started to look at the ear, the more I realized it's like a super radio with over 3,500 parallel channels. So they took the circular pattern of the ear and how it designed so that the outer ear handles the lower frequencies and the inner ear, as it gets smaller, handles the higher frequencies. Instead of using sound waves, they used electromagnetic waves, and they kind of copied the design of the ear, and they came up with a much better way to process sound and information, and they're now thinking that this may soon appear in some of the next generation cell phones and wireless devices. Again, an example of where a biological system was much more advanced than anything our best communication engineers could design, to the point where MIT scientists decided to copy it.
But of course, those biological systems were produced by a blind and unguided process of random mutation and natural selection, right?
Of course, yeah. 3,500 parallel channel radio just happened by chance. Again, I told you before, my background is a communication engineer, and I understand the amount of engineering that has to go in to build one of these systems. And so to make the argument that a communication system like this could happen by chance is beyond believable.
The number 9 story that you talked about was a very fascinating one. It isn't necessarily the most scientifically groundbreaking story, but given how much this issue has been talked about within the debate over evolution, I think it's absolutely worthy of being in your top 10 stories. And that is that the peppered moth, which was originally a light-colored moth in the wild, but when the Industrial Revolution took place and soot started to cover the trees, then those white moths would stand out. And the dark moths were actually more easily camouflaged and had a selective advantage, so they wouldn't be eaten by predators like birds. And so, as the story goes, the peppered moth shifted from white to black. Can you tell us a little about this story, and why is this interesting for people who follow the debate over evolution?
Yeah, well, it's migrating back to kind of a gray-white moth because the pollution on the trees has been reduced. And basically what this is oscillating evidence for oscillating selection, not a directional selection. And so we see this other places in nature, and the one I think of, again, that's often used as evidence for evolution is the Galapagos finches, when it was documented that the beak size of the finch changed during drought or rainy seasons. When it was drought, their beak sizes got larger so they could crack the nuts and survive on the foods there. But what they found out is that when the rainy seasons came back, the beak sizes shrank back to smaller sizes again. So you don't see any directional evolution there. What you see is adaptation, nature adapting to its environment. And so we see the same thing with the moth oscillating from black back to a kind of a gray-white now that its environment of pollution has changed. And yet these evidences are still used in textbooks today as evidence for evolution, evidence that the directional evolution that can explain our amoeba to man, you know, evolution, and yet we don't see that kind of direction happening in these examples.
That's absolutely right, Dennis. And I think that it's important to understand that, you know, when we first hear these stories of natural selection, we should wait and see what really happens. Is there net selection and is there net change to the species over time? And if there isn't, then we have to ask ourselves, what's really going on here? Is this a good example of how new species arise? Dennis, I think that 2009 might actually become known in this whole debate, aside from being the year of Darwin's 200th birthday, being the year of overhyping the evidence for evolution. And there were a couple interesting stories about overhyping the discovery of fossils in 2009. The first one I want to talk to you about is this species Ardipithecus ramidus. Now, of course, Ardi, as they're affectionately calling it, wasn't discovered in 2009. It was actually discovered in 1994. But it took about 15 years taking care and piecing Ardi back together under the microscope on a lab table in Berkeley, because when the bones are first discovered, they were completely smashed up. As a matter of fact, one news story said that the bones of Ardi was like, quote, Irish stew when they first found it. And there were a bunch of other interesting stories talking about how when they first touched the fossil, it would turn to dust because it was so chalky and just so brittle. So now in 2009, they finally performed reconstructive surgery on Ardipithecus ramidus, and they think they know what it looked like. And they're claiming that it was an upright walking ape, probably one of the ancestors of the Australopithecine apes, which are supposedly our ancestors as well. And we're supposed to believe that this reconstruction of this Irish stew fossil is accurate. What, in your opinion, was interesting about the story, and why was the evidence that they were putting forth and some of the claims they're making about already overhyped?
Well, first of all, I don't know how you take a pile of dust and convince anybody that you know something from it about our ancestry. It's just beyond the imagination, the way I like to say. And the fact that it took 15 years for them to even publish the evidence on it seems a bit suspicious, especially that they waited this year to bring it out, the year of Darwin. But the science editors at Science, what floored me, even though there were a lot of published articles that came out that we have links to in our website there that, you know, take exception to this evidence, they called it the science breakthrough of 2009. Not just the Darwin design story of 2009, they called this the overall science breakthrough of 2009. Again, it just floors me that they can take something that has so little evidence and extract such broad conclusions out of it. And I think if they are able to actually make any determinations about this, they're likely to find that, you know, this is very similar to any other fossil we had in the past, and it's only their reconstruction process that makes it look any different than anything else we know about.
Well, maybe, Dennis, the people at Science Magazine who said it was the science breakthrough were actually cosmetic and plastic surgeons, because in that sense, this is one of the greatest feats of cosmetic surgery ever, to reconstruct, you know, a 5-million-year-old fossil taking 15 years, and it was all smashed up and chalky when they first found it, and lo and behold, they've now explained to us exactly what it looked like. You know, for me, what was most interesting about this story was that they claimed that they had reconstructed the pelvis, which was actually described as Irish stew, and that they knew from the pelvis's reconstruction that Ardi was an upright walking bipedal ape-like species. Now, these claims of bipedality are dependent upon very, very minute measurements and very precise measurements of various bone angles on the pelvis and on other bones, and that's how they determined whether or not it was upright walking. And so, you know, I was actually doing an interview with a reporter from National Geographic a couple months ago about this, and he said, why don't you believe this? And I said, well, it's not that I am saying that Ardi was not an upright walking ape. Maybe she was. We just don't don't know for sure. The problem here is that they're making very bold and very dogmatic claims about this evidence when it's very difficult to say for sure if they've reconstructed it properly. And so I just think that a little bit more humility might have actually gone a long way in terms of how these fossils were promoted. Another good example of this was Ida. And I'm sure that many of our listeners who follow ID the Future podcast are very familiar with Ida. Ida was supposed to be the missing link to end all missing links that was discovered last year. And they actually created a documentary featuring David Attenborough that I believe was featured on the History Channel and BBC. And it was supposedly, you know, going to tell this grand story of our ancestry and our connection to lower primates. And what happened in the end with this fossil, Dennis?
Well, even Science Magazine came out, and the ones that promoted Artie, they came out with an article later in the year saying that there was much hype and many errors in interpretations of the evidence for this. And it's always suspicious when you have a documentary roll out at the same time that a discovery is announced. That tells you there's some staging going on behind the scenes here. This was a media event, not a science event.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it wasn't just science, but even the New York Times, you know, a stridently pro-Darwin media outlet, talked about how this was more of a story because of the way that the scientists were using the media to hype up this fossil. And there were actually a number of scientists, to their credit, who were very critical of the way that this issue and this fossil was being discussed to the public. And a lot of people said, actually, they weren't sure if it had really any evolutionary importance. It was a beautiful fossil, and everyone agreed with that. There's no doubt that it was an absolutely gorgeous fossil that was well preserved. But as far as its importance to the theory of evolution and connecting us to lower primates, I mean, a lot of people were very critical, saying that it wasn't clear that it had a very strong evolutionary importance whatsoever. And so, I mean, again, this is just really clearly we're seeing that when these fossils are promoted to the public, the people promoting it often have an agenda to try to push evolution. And so I think when we see the media talking about these missing links, we should really take these stories with a grain of salt. And Ida, I think, actually is convincing even some evolutionary scientists that they need to kind of tone down the rhetoric a little bit because they saw the botched media job behind Ida. And I think this is a very interesting story that will definitely be remembered for a long time.
Well, I think Ida and Artie in combination here make an interesting story. You know, you have Ida that was very well preserved, but face it, it was just a lemur and not much. It didn't really tell us much about our origins. And then you have Artie, who was Irish stew, a bowl of dust, and we have these fantastic reconstructions made out of that that, again, just require imagination to get any connection with our human origins out of it. So together, I think they kind of gave Darwin a black eye in a year that was supposed to be celebrating his theory.
It's interesting that when these alleged groundbreaking fossils are dug up, we see a lot of hype and emotion, not the sort of calm and cool collected scientific analysis that we would like to think would be coming from the scientific community. Well, let's go to story number 6. And this story came out in the journal BioEssays earlier last year that talked about how a materialistic basis is lacking from the Cambrian explosion. What can you tell us about this story, Dennis?
Well, the Cambrian explosion is something that, you know, the intelligent design community has been pointing to for a long time, and we feel that it's striking evidence against Darwinian evolution because instead of this tree that the theory of evolution proposes, it's like we have a forest that just suddenly sprouts out of the ground as far as the complexity of the fossils that you find all coming out of this Cambrian level at one time. That's why they call it the Cambrian explosion, is the explosion of life forms that you find all in a relatively short time frame, according to the evolutionary theory. And so when you see the scientific articles coming out in BioEssays admitting that their quote was thus elucidating the materialistic basis, or that means a plausible materialistic explanation of the Cambrian explosion has become more elusive, not less. The more we know about the event itself and cannot be explained away by coupling extinction of intermediates with long stretches of geologic time. So they're just fessing up to the evidence, and that's refreshing to see in the scientific literature. And then combined with that, we had Illustra Media release their DVD, excellent DVD, Darwin's Dilemma, The Mystery of the Cambrian Fossil Record. And I would highly recommend that for anybody that wants to understand these issues, because they did such a great job of bringing some of these fossils to life in 3D animation. It's where you get a chance to see the complexity, and then they graph out the evidence and charts and kind of show you how it's just upside down from what we expect from the theory of evolution.
And Dennis, there was a blog post that I put up on Evolution News in June of last year about this, and our listeners might be actually interested in reading it because it quotes in a little bit more detail a fascinating statement by the authors of this paper. And these authors, by the way, are no friends of intelligent design. They make that very clear in their paper. They are seeking a materialist basis for the Cameron explosion, but they had an interesting statement in their paper, and it was basically this. It said, quote, "The reasoning is simple, as explained on an intelligent design t-shirt. Fact. 40 phyla of complex animals suddenly appear in the fossil record. No foreigners, no transitional forms leading to them. A major mystery, a challenge. The theory of evolution exploded again," from idofcourse.com. And then they go on to comment about this statement, saying, quote, "Although we would dispute the numbers, and aside from the last line, the part where it says that the theory of evolution has exploded, they said there is not much here that we would disagree with. Indeed, many of Darwin's contemporaries share these sentiments, and we assume, if Victorian fashion dictated, that they would have worn this same t-shirt with pride," unquote. And so we often hear that there's this long, slow fuse to the Cambrian explosion, but the reality is that when you look at the fossil record, there is not a slow fuse. People assume that there's a slow fuse that had to have been there, but we don't see it in the fossil record. And so I think this is a paper that's definitely worth not forgetting and taking a look at in the future.
And the exciting thing about this story, and the reason it made our top 10, is people who don't support intelligent design are making these statements in the scientific literature. And I appreciate that about them. Even though they don't agree with intelligent design theory, they're honest scientists, and they're willing to stand up to what the data actually says. And I think that's important if we're going to make any progress in this debate.
Absolutely. Well, Dennis, I think we're running out of time for this podcast. We'll have to take this into a third podcast where we'll finish up the top five stories for Darwin and Design in 2009. For right now, though, where can listeners go to read about these stories on your website?
Yeah, if they can't wait to the next episode, Casey, send them to arn.org/top10. That's T-O-P-1-0. And we have our top 10 stories for the last couple of years there. They can pull down a PDF of the top stories for 2009 and read all about them if they can't wait to hear what the number one story is.
Well, that's excellent, Dennis. Thank you so much for your time. We'll come back with the top five Darwin and Design science stories from Access Research Network in 2009. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening to the ID of the Future podcast.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.